Hello and welcome to Crosstalk. I'm Peter Lavelle. Here we discuss some real news. Does the prisoner exchange portend settlement of other outstanding issues such as Ukraine? And why is the United States sending a flotilla to protect Israel after Israel carries out assassinations? To discuss these issues and more, I'm joined by my guest, George Samueli in Budapest. He is a podcaster at The Gaggle, which can be found on YouTube and Locals. And in Istanbul, we have Tariq Sarı Amar. He is a historian and political commentator. All right, gentlemen, Crosstalk rules in effect. That means you can jump anytime you want, and I always appreciate it. All right, let's start out with George in Budapest. A great fanfare about the prisoner exchange, how vast it was, and the number of people that were freed, and the type of people, only good guys came back, and only bad guys went back to Russia. This usual meme and all of this. You know, you can dissect it all you want. It's the biggest prisoner exchange since the Cold War. But what struck me most about the prisoner exchange is that it happened at all. And it, after all, in looking at the exchange, diplomacy is possible, apparently, something the Biden administration hasn't been doing since the first day. Your thoughts, George?
No, you're absolutely right, Peter, because what was involved here was indeed a very complicated, intricate diplomacy involving a number of different states and very intricate logistics. And your obvious question arises, well, if you can do that, if you could put all so much energy into bringing home a few individuals, why can't you use some of that energy to affect a peaceful outcome? And of course, that's really the issue, that it's assumed that, of course, this is of no significance, that this is absolutely a separate issue. And it was raised in a news conference with Jake Sullivan that, well, does this mean that there's any chance of a negotiations on Ukraine? No. There's no. That's a separate track. You know, that's it. So this is apparently so important. You know, we have Biden and Harris flying to meet these individuals. We have Jake Sullivan giving all these briefings to reporters. But the much more important, the idea of saving hundreds of thousands of lives, that's not on the agenda. No, let's just stick to this rather minor issue. And you have to conclude that no, I don't think anything is likely to come out of this.
Yeah, but Teddy, that's a choice, okay? Because under normal circumstances, you'd think, well, this is a starting point. Compromises can be found, strategies can be devised. But they shut the door on it, absolutely. So it does kind of tell us a little bit more about intent. I mean, diplomacy is a one-off instead of should be the usual course of matters between states. Tariq.
Yes, I think you're right. I think you're both right. I would add only two or three observations. One is if you compare, this exchange diplomacy with what could be done, but will not be done, I think, regarding the war in Ukraine, then the exchange diplomacy has two very interesting features. First of all, the United States actually pressured a very important client or ally, if you want to be polite, namely Germany, to do something the Germans absolutely didn't want to do. So about Ukraine, we hear again and again that we can't do that because the Ukrainians aren't ready to do that yet. But obviously, it is possible to pressure a client to do things they claim they're not ready to do. So that has been unmasked as a pretext once again. The other thing is, of course, if you think in terms of the oft-cited values, right? The reasons the Germans cited why they didn't want to let Krasikov go were typical value reasons, right? He has been sentenced, he has to stay here, and so on and so on. And in the end, that as well could be overcome. So once again, we see that there are two things we hear again and again about why we can't negotiate about Ukraine, that in this case could be easily, maybe not easily, but actually effectively be dealt with, right? But I also think that this unfortunately will not set an example for Ukraine. I think there are several reasons. One is the big geopolitics. I think the only thing that will finally induce negotiations in the case of Ukraine is that the defeat by Russia will become so obvious that everybody wants to get out and save what's left to save. And apparently they're not even there yet. But the other reason has to do with lobbying. If you look at this exchange diplomacy, one important point is that to be exchanged, to get onto that list on the Western or the American side, you have to have lobbies. You have to have people who talk for you in very important places. Now, what sort of lobbies do the Ukrainians have? They have an extremely influential, I think, diaspora, that's what they call it, in Northern America and the United States and in Canada. But unfortunately, that Ukrainian lobby is lobbying for war, right? Exactly for the opposite. They are not trying to save their country by lobbying for negotiations. They come out of the old, very tired nationalist strain that goes back to World War II, interwar period, and so on. And they're still totally militant, and they don't want to see peace. They don't want to see negotiations. They want to see war. So I'm also pessimistic. I think this will not happen.
Well, one of the things that, you know, it's kind of an inconvenient observation is that when diplomacy was applied, and I'm thinking of the Istanbul process, it had a lot. I mean, drafts were drawn up and pages initialed. I mean, it isn't separate. It was actually tried, and nobody wants to talk about it. You know, the three of us knew what was going on in Istanbul. This is a few weeks after the conflict, at least this phase of the conflict started. We were talking about it in real time. It took months and months and months for that to seep into the mainstream media, because it is so inconvenient now. So we have an intricate hostage exchange, multiple countries. Tarika's absolutely right. The Germans didn't want to let their captive to go, even though he was a war criminal and should have been turned over to Russia for his involvement in the Chechen wars. And, you know, and but we have the ability to do it. It's just the lack of will to do it. That's the major takeaway for me about this hostage exchange.
That's exactly right, Peter. There is a complete lack of will. And, we look now at the situation that the only thing that matters in the West is the U.S. presidential election. I mean, ultimately, there's going to be no movement at all until the election is settled. But even then, it's very unlikely, really, that whoever is occupying the Oval Office on January the 20th, 2025, is going to make any serious moves to bring this war to an end. And that largely that there is enormously powerful lobbies kind of from, you know, the military, the security apparatus, the political elites of Washington to move on peace, because any kind of a peace will immediately be deemed surrendering to Putin, you know, selling out Ukraine, throwing Ukraine.
The 21st century's version of Munich.
Exactly. You know, who lost Ukraine? That's clear. So, you know, if it's Harris who's in the Oval Office, well, Harris has to worry about her re-election. She doesn't want to go into a re-election dubbed as the person who sold out Kiev. And, Trump knows he's already been impeached twice. He would be very much in danger of being impeached a third time if he started making serious moves. So it's very unlikely. Now, one other option is, would Biden in the last 6 months think, hey, this will be my legacy, I'm going to bring this thing to an end? But why should Biden do that? I think Biden will say, hey, I'm going to just dump this on my successor. It's going to be their war. Come January the 20th, I'll already be forgotten, and everything that will have to be done by the others. So therefore, there's no incentive at all in the United States to bring this thing to an end.
You know, Tarik, there are people that are saying, and I vehemently disagree with them, that Putin wanted to do this before a Trump administration. This was a window to deal with the Biden administration. I don't think it makes any sense at all. I think Looking at the number of people that were exchanged, and it's quite copious and it's very complicated, is that everything fell into place and they decided everything's in place. Let's do it now because things can fall apart. That's how I look at it. It has nothing to do with the administration in the United States.
Regarding the timing, I would agree with you, Peter, because this has been such a complicated process. There was also a major hiccup when they had advanced quite far and then Navalny died and everything was set back. So I think the people involved on the Russian side as well had the experience that, well, once you have this actually under wraps, you better do it before things fall apart again. So that makes sense to me. I would like to diverge a little bit from George on one thing. I agree with him that, you know, the deep state, to put it simply, is interested in continuing the war for many, many reasons. But I'm not quite sure that we can be certain that Trump would not make peace. The reason is not that Trump has said he will make peace. I understand he can break his word. That's clear. The reason is that I think on the Trump side, we have really quite a few people who want to wrap this up or at least leave it to the Europeans, which is another option, so that they can entirely turn towards China and maybe toward the Middle East in case we don't do the big war right now, of course. The other thing is, I feel that George is right. Trump has been impeached before. But you could read this the other way around. You could also read Trump as somebody who has learned that impeachment doesn't actually stop him. And Trump, in some ways, I think, may be even more self-confident now than he was in his first term. So I'm not entirely disagreeing, but I wouldn't rule out the possibility that a Trump presidency could perhaps make a difference on the Ukrainian issue.
Okay, George, you've got 1 minute. The Russians that wanted to leave Russia that went to the United States, are they a nascent government in exile? That's a big question with little time. Go ahead.
I think they are a nascent government, exactly. And I think that was part of the objective, is to create this opposition grouping that will be deemed, you know, well, like constantly consulted in the media that, you know, about developments in Russia and so on and so on, that we, you know, maybe we can think about them in the future to impose them on a defeated, broken Russia.
But yeah, I hear Guaido is giving master classes in governments in exile. I mean, and you can't think of a better place to have a master class. You know, some in Florida, the weather's nice. You know, it's, you know, season round. So it's kind of it could be a textbook example of how you can do it and how it always fails. All right, gentlemen, we're going to go to a hard break. And after that hard break, we'll continue our discussion on some real news. Stay with RT. Welcome back to Crosstalk. I'm Peter Lavelle. Here we discuss some real news. Okay, let's go back to Istanbul. Tariq, we're in a very precarious time right now. We have the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu goading the United States as if he was the second coming in the U.S. Congress, probably the most disgraceful hour in the history of the Congress, at least in my opinion. He goes back, then we have a series of very high-profile assassinations, of course. The Israeli side and its major supporter, the United States, knew that retaliation is about to incur. We're still in that moment right now. What are your thoughts about how things are playing out?
I obviously also don't know. I think what seems obvious to me is what the Israelis are trying to do. I think the Israelis are trying to trigger a larger war. But they're trying to trigger it through Iran. They're trying to leave the Iranian leadership no alternative to a response that is so substantial, unlike the one they had in April, right? That in the end, it triggers a wider war and brings in above all the Americans, who of course have immediately obliged and sent the usual aircraft carrier strike group and reinforced their forces in other ways. As well. I mean, we see the perversity, the schizophrenia of American policy once again very clearly. It's not new, it's an old play. We get to hear from the Biden administration that Biden has talked really tough with Netanyahu now and told him something. But at the same time, this administration never exerts any real leverage. which, and this is the peak of this perversion, would be incredibly easy because Israel is incredibly dependent on the United States. Except, of course, that in some way the whole American establishment is now incredibly dependent on Israel. It is, in my view, the greatest and the worst case of subversion of politics, sovereignty, democracy, as far as that term even makes sense in the United States, that I can imagine. All this talk about Russian meddling with American elections is ridiculous. The right. country that has meddled massively with the American political process is, of course, Israel. And unfortunately, there seems to be no stopping it at this point. I hope it will stop one day.
Yeah, it's very interesting. You know, George, you know, Netanyahu is probably singularly the most hated man in Israel right now. His foray into Gaza has turned into a disaster. Up to 100,000 people have had to evacuate the northern part of Israel because of the skirmishes with Hezbollah. He's picking a fight with the Houthi, wants the United States to get involved with Iran. His current record is pretty abysmal, except his ability to influence the American media and political class. It's really amazing. He's very good at one thing. He's got himself in Israel into in an enormously dangerous situation. George.
That's a very good summary. It is quite extraordinary that, you know, within days, Israel carries out these two high-profile assassinations, and the United States says, "Well, we had nothing to do with it. You know, Israel never bothered to consult us. However, we don't actually approve and we don't disapprove of what Israel did. Okay. However, we are sending in our forces because Iran might retaliate, and therefore we are under an obligation to defend Israel." Well, this doesn't really make any sense. So you're saying that, well, Israel just went off, did this thing, and you neither approve nor disapprove of what Israel did, but you're putting American people on the hook to protect Israel, who just carries out and does these things without even consulting you before it does them. And then you have to ask, well, what kind of a leadership is this in the United States, where you take the American people to the brink of war for a foreign state? And this is why it's just a very dangerous situation, because why exactly is the United States preparing for a war with Iran over the actions of Israel? I mean, the Biden administration continues with this nonsense that, well, we're very, very close to a peace agreement. We're in the last, you know, the 10-yard line. And then the moment you start reading, well, what actually is this peace agreement? And it's clear there is no agreement on anything.
And George, it looks like the ceasefire agreement is a conversation among Americans and some of its European allies, but has nothing to do with the Israelis. But we won't need to find that out in the mainstream media. Tariq, one of the interesting phrases that I keep hearing, we have the United States and backing Israel has to escalate to de-escalate. That's a very dangerous proposition. I mean, because escalation is in the eye of the beholder, okay? I mean, you can't determine what someone else will, how they will determine, you know, this is a signal that we need to de-escalate because he's escalating. This is like pop psychology of the worst kind.
Yes, I mean, it's also an interesting thing that escalate to de-escalate is something that Americans often ascribe to Russian policy. They actually maintain that there is a Russian policy of escalation to achieve de-escalation. And when they do that, they, of course, criticize it with very similar arguments that you have just advanced. It's, of course, nonsense, because to go back to the individual case here, it simply disregards the fact that Israel then has a blank check to, inside that relationship, provoke Iran as much as they like, as fiercely as they like. There's never any limit to Israel. So the Iranian leadership is left sooner or later with no alternative but either to completely lose credibility or to strike back hard. Again, not like in April, but seriously. In April, that was theater. We all know this, right? So this whole idea that you escalate to de-escalate, that is, you sort of up the ante to deter Iran, is first of all absurd, but it is even more absurd because it could only possibly make any sense at all if you controlled Israel. But the United States abstains from ever controlling Israel. That is the core of the problem here.
You know, George, who is running this policy out of Washington? Because we know it's not Joe Biden. We know it's not Kamala Harris. I mean, I think you probably saw her word salad going back to our previous issue of the prisoner exchange. I call her word salad Karen. That's how I describe her. But I mean, this is an opportunity again for Netanyahu to manipulate. I mean, because where is the center of power when it comes to U.S. policy in the Middle East right now?
No, exactly. We simply don't know who's running the show, which itself is quite shocking. I mean, we're familiar with all the media stories, with the media which rejoiced that Biden got out of the race because Biden's obviously completely mentally incompetent. But then that same media,
who's president?
Yeah, show no curiosity. Well, okay, so he's completely mentally incompetent, doesn't know where he is. Who then is running the foreign policy with the, you know, two dangerous confrontations that America is heavily involved in? And so, I mean, in the meantime, you have the Republicans who are attacking Biden for selling Israel out, you know, for betrayal of Israel. But what is dangerous, I think Tariq alluded to that, is that Iran really is now in a very, very difficult position, because if it does nothing, then that will be interpreted not only as weakness, but as a vindication of U.S.-Israeli policy. You see, we faced down Iran. We threatened Iran. We told them, you try anything and you're going to be dealing with the United States. And Iran backed away. That shows that muscular diplomacy works. If, of course, it does what it did in April, then again, it just becomes a kind of a global laughingstock. You know, you're just doing this kind of, you know, theatrical nonsense. So Iran really has no option other than to do something serious. And that, of course, is dangerous. And again, that means America, as far as the U.S. policymakers goes, and that's what Lloyd Austin said, America's now on the hook to go to war on behalf of Israel.
Yeah, but again, the absurdity is the United States will defend Israel as Israel is conducting offensive operations. Again, you know, nobody likes to discuss that. Tariq, we're almost out of time. I think what makes this moment so uniquely dangerous is because you have the axis of resistance been planning, as George and I have been told numerous times, like Professor Mirandi on this program, they've been planning this for a long time. For Netanyahu and his radical right-wing government, this is all an opportunity. Both sides now, axis of resistance, Netanyahu's government, both look at this as solving all problems all at once. That's what's very dangerous about this. It's very existential now.
You know, I agree regarding the Israelis. I fear that you're absolutely right there. But I wouldn't quite agree with Iran and its allies, right? Because, look, if they thought, for instance, Hezbollah, thought that the biggest chunk out of it, the biggest single chunk, as it were, apart from Iran, if they thought that this is an opportunity to clear everything up once and for all, to solve this issue, I think they would already have attacked. And so if you look at Hezbollah's behavior, at Nasrallah's speech, even after Fuad Shukri was killed, right? If you look at his speech, they're still being careful, actually, and one can understand why, because Israel is trying to impose its timing on them, right? And that is not advantageous to them. So I'm actually, the weird thing, it's not weird, actually, it actually makes a lot of sense. The rational actors here is Iran and its allies. The completely insane actor, but now, is Israel, and behind that, the West.
George, last 30 seconds goes to you.
Well, the most insane, I think.
No pressure on you. No pressure.
The most insane is the United States, because the United States is on the hook for going to war not for, on its own behalf, not for, to realize any American interest, but on the on behalf of Israel, and a timing decided by Israel. That really doesn't make any sense. What Netanyahu is doing makes sense. He wants to bring America in. He's been doing that for a long time, bringing America in on Israel's behalf. Why America agrees to this, which is a very dangerous situation, that does remain a big mystery.
Well, maybe that'll be the topic of next week's program. All right, gentlemen, that's all the time we have. I want to thank my guests in Budapest and in Istanbul. And of course, I want to thank our viewers for watching us here, RT. See you next time. Remember, Crosstalk Rules.